Chapter 11. Azar gives in. It was not until July 26, 1914, that the tread of marching troops in St. Petersburg echoed in Berlin, when imprecise rumors as to the Tsar's decision to mobilize a million soldiers began to reach the German capital. Bethmann Hollweg immediately informed the British government of his concern. In Vienna, 2 days later, the situation had deteriorated still further thanks to the delay in the arrival of the conciliatory messages of Wilhelm II and Sir Edward Grey. The dual monarchy was rattling its sword with a declaration of war that sober heads recognized was largely rhetorical. It was still likely that all that would come from it would be the dispatch of a few old tubs down the Danube to lob a few shells at Belgrade, already abandoned by the Serbian government at the order of their Tsarist masters. If the Austrian government really meant business, the 2 weeks it would take to mobilize the Austrian army would allow ample time for negotiations. The Russian Panslavists, of course, had no intention of seeing their carefully laid plans for a Balkan conflagration thwarted. The idea that a last-moment intervention by wiser heads might upset their plans filled them with fear and rage. On July 28, Sazonov called on Tsar Nicholas and obtained 2 ukases, which he promptly forwarded to General Yanushkevich. The first decreed the mobilization of the 4 military districts of Moscow, Kiev, Odessa, and Kazan, as had already been provided for on July 24, 1914, and put in motion by the Russian General Staff. Now it had the official sanction of the Russian autocrat. The second decree ordered a general mobilization, which followed, as we have shown, inexorably from a partial mobilization according to the planning of the General Staff. The Tsar, who was as poorly informed about the military strategy of his generals as he was about many affairs in his realm, was unaware of this. He had been led, unwittingly, into a trap from which he could no longer extricate himself, a trap which would see him and his family slaughtered and the Romanov dynasty expunged from Russia. As everyone in St. Petersburg and Paris knew, mobilization meant war. From the first day of the Franco-Russian alliance in 1894, this was understood. The statements of the principal actors in the drama confirm it. General Obruchev, the Russian chief of staff at the time of the treaty, said, "Our mobilization should immediately be followed by acts of war." The Tsar, at that time Alexander III, concurred, "That is just as I understand it." General Beuzdorfer, who represented France in the negotiations, was equally explicit: mobilization is the declaration of war. René Guérin, the great French intellectual and patriot, who co-authored Les responsabilités de la guerre with Poincaré, wrote, "If my declared enemy aims a revolver at me, and if I know he is a good shot, I must conclude that he wishes to kill me, that he is going to kill me. Should I wait until he had fired to be certain of his intentions?" On July 28, 1914, the Tsarist Empire drew its guns. General Dobrovolsky, commander-in-chief of the Russian mobilization, was quite definite about it. As far as he was concerned, from the reception of the order to mobilize, the march of events would be automatic and irreversible. "I was called upon to set fire to the woodpile of the world," he would state, without batting an eye. The Tsar, when he had allowed his minister, Sazonov, to extract the 2 mobilization orders from him, murmured, "Think of the thousands and thousands of men who are going to be sent to their deaths." He badly underestimated the coming slaughter. In Berlin, Kaiser Wilhelm stood firm even as events hurtled toward disaster, still refusing to accept war as inevitable. No longer able to meet face to face with Nicholas, whom he might well have swayed, as he did once before, he had only the telegraph as his last resort. The Tsar was now effectively the prisoner of his generals and his ministers. Behind them, lashing them on, stood the French ambassador Paleolog, egged on by Poincaré. The German leaders tried in vain to budge the emperors of Russia and Austria. Wilhelm bombarded Austria's Franz Joseph with telegrams urging negotiations with the Russian leadership. The Kaiser sent similar messages to the Tsar. Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg exerted all his powers of threat and persuasion to convince his opposite number in the Austro-Hungarian government, Berchtold, to accept England's proposal that Belgrade be temporarily occupied by Austria while the great powers negotiated a solution to the impasse. He telegraphed his ambassador, Count Skirsky, we are, of course, completely prepared to do our duty as an ally, but we must refuse to let Vienna draw us into a worldwide conflagration, in disregard of our advice. I urge you to speak to Count Berchtold immediately, and with great emphasis. 16 years later, Poincaré would acknowledge that Berchtold had replied to this affirmatively, and that he had been ready to waive compensation. When questioned by Skirsky, who had received his instructions, Count Berchtold proved willing to declare that Austria made no territorial claims. Poincaré, Les responsabilités de la guerre, page 167. The message of Wilhelm II which reached Nicholas II at that time was equally emphatic: I am using all my influence with the Austrians to get them to seek some basis of agreement with you without any mental reservations. Even in Wilhelm's absence, his entreaties made a powerful impression on the Tsar. Nicholas roused himself sufficiently to quit his apartment and descend to the front hall, where the only telephone in the palace was located. Mouth close to the receiver, he ordered the chief of the general staff, General Yanishkevich, to rescind the order for general mobilization immediately, retaining only the order for partial mobilization. Yanishkevich, reinforced by Sukhomlinov, the Minister of War, dared to call the Tsar back to the telephone. According to them, regional mobilization would throw the army into disorder and make it impossible to carry out a general mobilization, the only mobilization that could be of any military value in the circumstances. The Tsar's change of heart was all the more impracticable for the general staff because the general mobilization, unbeknownst to the Tsar, was already underway. France's military attaché in Moscow, Captain Laguiche, had learned on July 26 of Russian measures for mobilization in progress as far west as Warsaw, and informed his government by telegraph. By July 29, the general Russian mobilization was being carried out almost openly along the Prussian border. One of General Dobrorolsky's reports noted, in the Suwalki district, which abuts the border of East Prussia, the general mobilization had already begun. L'Histoire de Macquarie, page 66. During the night of July 29 to 30, 1914, there ensued a crossfire of almost unbelievable telephone conversations. First the Tsar himself, in a completely uncharacteristic interference for that weak-willed ruler, had called the chief of the general staff. Immediately afterwards Yanishkevich, instead of obeying his Tsar, rang up the Minister of War, Sukhomlinov. "What shall I do?" he asked the minister. Sukhomlinov replied immediately, "Don't do anything." At the other end of the line, the chief of the general staff exclaimed, "Thank God." The direct, personal order of the Tsar had been circumvented. The next morning, July 30, Sukhomlinov lied to Nicholas, informing the Tsar that he had complied with the order to cease the general mobilization and restrict the army's preparations to regional mobilization. In fact, he was doing exactly the opposite. In 1917, when Sukhomlinov would stand trial for his numerous failings, he would confess publicly that, "The following morning, I lied to the Tsar. I told him that the partial mobilization was limited to the command posts of the southwest." That morning it was also Sazonov's turn to lie to Nicholas. He explained to his sovereign that Austria was already carrying out military operations on Russian soil. This was totally untrue, as Sazonov was well aware, but it was needless to say highly persuasive to the vacillating monarch. The Tsar sent Kaiser Wilhelm the following pathetic telegram: "I foresee that I am soon going to be overcome by the pressure being put on me, and I shall be forced to take extreme measures leading to war." Sazonov, pressing his advantage, routed the Tsar from his chambers, where he and the Tsarina were tending their son, the little hemophiliac crown prince. Tsarina Alexandra, nerves at the breaking point, sought to counsel her husband not to give in, for she loathed the Grand Dukes and their Panslavist obsession. Then Sazonov let fly the arrow that would strike this proud but devoted wife and mother to the quick. He told her, "You are asking the Tsar to sign his own death warrant." This threat, scarcely veiled, had been confirmed by George Malcolm Thompson, who wrote, "Nobody should put aside as impossible any wild outcome of those feverish hours in the Tsar's palace by the sea. It was blackmail by threat of assassination." The Tsar received a final telegram from the Kaiser, My ambassador has instructions to draw the attention of your government to the serious dangers and consequences of a mobilization. Austria-Hungary has mobilized only against Serbia and only a part of her army. If Russia mobilizes against Austria-Hungary, the role of mediator, which you have accepted in accordance with your express wish, will be threatened, if not rendered impossible. The entire weight of the decision now rests on your shoulders. Yours to bear the responsibility of war or peace. Willy. The burden of decision is crushing Nicholas II. His evasions at an end, he now received the war party in his office. Ushered in, they lined up facing the Tsar, the Minister of War, his generals, the civilian officials. Sazonov, speaking clearly and decisively, challenged the Tsar, "I don't think your majesty should hesitate any longer to make the decree of general mobilization effective again." Again the Tsar murmured his argument, "Consider that it means sending tens of thousands of men to die." Sazonov, "The halting of our mobilization would upset our military organization and disconcert our allies." Another imposture of Sazonov's, by which he implied that the French would be shocked at the Tsar's torpor and think that he was violating the terms of their alliance. At that moment, of course, Poincaré, just returned from his journey, was playing the role of the innocent in Paris. Finally, everyone fell silent. The Tsar, eyes bulging, his face a sickly yellow, made no reply. He stood motionless, as if petrified. Suddenly General Tatishev broke the silence, "Yes, it is a difficult decision." The Tsar started as though he'd been slapped. He paced back and forth, and then looked straight at his audience. "I am the one who decides." And he decided. He ordered Sazonov to telephone Yanushkevich that he was again signing a decree for general mobilization. Thompson has fixed the scene forever. The tension in the room broke. Sazonov rose, bowed, and almost ran to the telephone on the floor below. He passed the order triumphantly to Yanushkevich, adding, "Now you can smash your telephone."